It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. After a listening tour that took him to 67 counties over 4 months to assess Pennsylvanians' attitudes on whether to legalize recreational marijuana, Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman released details of his findings on Wednesday. Lieutenant Governor, welcome back to the Confluence.
Yeah, always great to be on.
Your report indicated 65 to 70% of people who provided feedback supported legalization. Does that number surprise you?
No, it doesn't surprise me. It's consistent with anecdotally everything that I've witnessed, you know, during my political career. And the people are way out in front of the laws on this subject. And it's time the laws catch up to where the people are at.
How did you develop those numbers? People filling out surveys on site when you visited each county? What about online input?
Yes, all of it. You know, if you reached out and gave an opinion in person, on paper, online, all of that was tabulated and considered. We had over 10,000 Pennsylvanians come out to the various town halls and the listening sessions. We had over 40,000 Pennsylvanians leave comments on the webpage. We had countless opinions and comments made on social media as well too. So this is the most comprehensive outreach that I could ever recall on a public policy topic here in Pennsylvania. So one thing's abundantly clear is people want to talk about it, and they have strong views on it. And those views are overwhelmingly in support of decriminalization and expungement of these kind of small marijuana offenses and paraphernalia, that cannabis doesn't in any way belong as a Schedule I substance. And the point of 65 to 70% of people support adult use recreational cannabis. To be very clear, and this is kind of my drop line, is prohibition is a definitive minority position on cannabis in Pennsylvania.
Can you recall maybe a compelling argument, a compelling comment that you heard in favor of legalization during these listening tour events, and even one that maybe struck you for against it?
Well, some of the most poignant ones came from our veterans, where they lamented with outrage. They're like, you know, I was harmed and damaged in the defense of my country, and my country considers me a criminal to use the one substance, cannabis, that helps make me feel normal and helps me survive, helps me not want to harm myself. And the VA won't give it to me. The VA calls me a criminal, and we need to stop this. It's insane. And I would say on the opposite side, it's parents that are concerned, out of love. I mean, and I'm a parent, and of course I get that. So, conflating harmless with legal is a false equivalent or a false argument. There are many substances that are dangerous, like tobacco or alcohol, but they're legal, but they're tightly regulated, they're taxed, their distribution is controlled, and everyone believes that marijuana more aptly belongs in that basket of goods, not the heroin and meth and some of those other substances. And no one, we did not encounter one single person that advocated that marijuana legal use in Pennsylvania should be below 21. Everyone agrees that this is a 21 or over kind of proposition.
So about 2 out of 3 approximately said they favored legalization. If the numbers were different, that more Pennsylvanians opposed than supported legalization, would you, as Lieutenant Governor, still want to legalize marijuana?
I would. I would note that when I ran for the Senate in 2016, I was the only candidate that was for full legalization. So the views on this are evolving rapidly. Medical marijuana in Pennsylvania has done an amazing job of helping change the hearts and minds of other people that were skeptical otherwise. And you know what? We legalized medical marijuana and the world didn't spin off its axis. We legalized CBD and the world hasn't spun off its axis. I think a lot of this is just fear of a substance that the more it is known, the more people experience it in a legal, controlled, regulated setting, more people come to understand that this is something that belongs in a basket of substances like tobacco and alcohol that are perfectly legal, but are tightly regulated, taxed, and their distribution is controlled.
Governor Wolf and you have outlined some steps you'd like to see taken by the legislature, including decriminalizing possession of small amounts of marijuana, expunging past convictions of nonviolent and possession of small amounts. Do they go hand in hand, those two aspects?
They do. They do. And look, while we wait for legislation, we're doing it right now. I chair the Board of Pardons, and we have no fee. And we are going to be aggregating and expediting those type of convictions. So apply. If you have one of those convictions, apply. And the only thing you stand to lose is your record. And it's wrong that individuals have their lives harmed, their professional opportunities, their reputation, their ability to get a loan, their ability to get a job, their ability to volunteer with their children's school, you name it. You know, it's wrong that exists, and we are doing that. We're doing expungement by pardon. Ideally, we'd like to do it through legislation. But until that day comes, we are doing it right now, today, on that. And that's what I want for Pennsylvania, and that's what the governor wants and supports us in doing.
The administration and the legislature has talked a lot about criminal justice reform over the last couple of years. How do these particular recommendations fit into that?
I think it dovetails perfectly. Look, let's be honest. We have a lot of great Republican thought leaders in our legislature that support our criminal justice reform efforts. And I'm grateful for that because we need them on board. And to their credit, they are. And they're taking these comprehensive, bipartisan steps to reform criminal justice in a sense that makes sense for everybody and can correct some of these mistakes that we've made in the past.
The governor said in the statement on release of the report, the findings, quote, "We now know the majority of Pennsylvanians are in favor of legalization, and that includes me," end quote. Last year, when I asked him about recreational marijuana, he said wasn't quite the right time. Did you twist his arm a little bit?
The governor is his own man, his own views, and his views, I think, are where Pennsylvania is really at. And some people say, well, put it on the ballot. It's like, well, we can't put it on the ballot. It's unconstitutional we don't have ballot referendums in Pennsylvania. Short of that, this was the most comprehensive, open way to really find out where Pennsylvanians at. And look, I don't have a dog in this fight, other than I believe in this as part of common sense criminal justice reform to free people from these charges, to free people from the shadows and the black market of an illegal cannabis market and just get it out into the open. And we can move on to more pressing public policy issues than this substance, which I would note has led to zero overdose deaths that I'm aware of medically or that anyone's aware of when we have 70,000 deaths of opioid overdoses in our country every year.
So now the legislature, what do you really think are the chances of, number one, passage of a bill to decriminalize, and then, if that happens, passage of legislation to legalize?
We have hearts and minds to move in the legislature. And I have a great deal of respect for the leadership on the other side. And we demonstrated that Pennsylvanians want to talk about this. We've demonstrated, I think, conclusively that Pennsylvanians have a direction that they want the state to go. And ultimately, I have faith in the leadership that they're going to come around to those views. But by no means, it's a slam dunk. And I think it's everyone out there has to reach out to their legislator in a respectful way and say, look, I want this, and this makes sense. And I would remind any Republican who's skeptical, a majority of your party, your colleagues, your voters, your constituents support this. There's an incredibly strong and wide libertarian streak within the Republican Party. And they are incredulous that the government is withholding this, stopping them, telling them what they can do in the comfort and safety of their own home on a substance that, as I alluded to earlier, is responsible for exactly none overdose deaths. I think they'll eventually come around. It's like many things in our society. And then when it happens, it's like, oh, yeah, it's not, you know, somehow the world didn't explode.
Final question. Legalization, regulation, taxation, how important to you would be the revenues that would come from that?
Well, of course the revenues are important, and not one single resident thinks we should just throw it into the general fund and hope it all works out. They would want it directly targeted to very specific issues, whether it was the running joke of pot for potholes and fix the damn road, so to speak, or public education, or you name it. They think all those funds should be earmarked for the cause that the legislature and the people can agree on.
Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman, thanks so much.
Okay, thanks for having me on.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence. Autonomous vehicles have been learning to navigate Pittsburgh's crowded streets. But how would they do in a highway construction zone, maneuvering through narrow lanes, cones, and shifting traffic patterns? PennDOT is teaming up with CMU to find out. And the role of libraries is evolving in local communities. What conversations would you like to hear on The Confluence? Send us an email with your suggestion to confluence@wesa.fm. You can find conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of the show on our website at wesa.fm/confluence.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Ariel Worthy. How do you change the minds of climate deniers? Lee McIntyre is a philosopher of science and talks with the Allegheny Front on how to confront myths about science. And a rare and potentially deadly virus that is transmitted by mosquitoes has been confirmed in Erie, Carbon, and Monroe counties. The virus was found in pheasants, horses, and a wild turkey. Find more top news stories from the WESA newsroom at WESA.fm.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Many of us have spotted autonomous vehicles on Pittsburgh streets, sharing the road with other cars and bikes. Now the Pennsylvania Department of Transportation wants to know how self-driving cars can do in highway work zones. Mark Kopko is the director of PennDOT's Office of Transformational Technology. Welcome to The Confluence, Mark.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So, Mark, PennDOT recently received an $8.4 million grant from the U.S. Department of Transportation. What exactly will you be using that money for?
Sure. We'll be using this money to figure out ways that we can safely integrate automated vehicles into work zones. So the concept behind the USDOT Automated Driving Systems Demonstration Grant Program was to try and figure out areas where we see that there are gaps between where the market is right now and where it needs to be when you have actual full deployment. From the department standpoint, it made sense for us to look at work zones. It's a perfect scenario where it makes sense for industry and for the infrastructure owner operators to work together. We control the work zones and their vehicles are going to be operating. It makes sense for us to have those conversations back and forth and figure out a way that we can safely integrate it, knowing that vehicles are on the road right now, testing in certain jurisdictions. But additionally, we know that there's levels of automation in production vehicles right now, lower levels of automation, but still nonetheless, there's automated features, whether it be adaptive cruise control, lane keeping technology, that we want to figure out ways that we can have to integrate these so that everything can operate safely in work zones, not only in the future, but now.
Has there been any evaluation previously of how the autonomous vehicles perform in work zones?
There's not been much evaluation of any at all right now that's occurred. If you look at a lot of the testing that's occurring around the country, traditionally testers and researchers and developers, either revert control over the human operators at work zones, or they tend to avoid them altogether just because of the variable nature. Any type of pre-mapping that you've done, if it's a temporary work zone, odds are it's changed since you've last gone through. So there's a variety of things that we need to examine in order to make sure that they can successfully operate in any type of work zone that they can encounter.
Have you, as PennDOT, studied how the autonomous vehicles perform on major roadways more generally outside of work zones, the Turnpike, for example, or any other major roadway?
We have a testing authorization program in place in the Commonwealth. So we work with testers to verify that they're taking the appropriate steps to ensure the safe operations and testing of these vehicles on roadways. As we see through that program, we have conversations and we can see how things progress. And we know that testing is occurring in a variety of scenarios or a variety of areas, whether it be on limited access, arterial roadways, closed testing facilities within the Commonwealth. But we see that things are progressing. We would just like to see it progress in work zones too, so that we know that everything's safe when you ultimately get to a deployment in the future.
You're partnering with Carnegie Mellon University through this grant. What services will they provide?
Sure. Carnegie Mellon University is going to provide a couple services. One, they are bringing the automated vehicle to the program. So they have an automated Cadillac SRX that some might have seen them test around the Pittsburgh region. With that, we also are using them to do simulation testing and, frankly, just utilize their expertise. You know, being one of the birthplaces of automation and a leading academic institution in the world in this field, having them at the table helping out, it just makes that process that much easier.
I understand you'll also be working with PPG. How so?
PPG is a partner that joined our team here looking at innovative coatings that they're utilizing. Knowing that a lot of the sensors are pretty consistent between vehicles, looking at radar, LIDAR, camera sensors, we knowing that there's some materials that, especially when it comes to things like LIDAR, and that the sensors just cannot read as well. So they are developing coatings to make standard objects, whether it be a vehicle or other surfaces that you can paint with these coatings, just stand out, pop out more to these sensors, so that it just makes it that much easier for a vehicle to detect and navigate around objects.
Might the coatings be on the cones, the barrels, even maybe the safety vests of workers?
We're looking at all that, from actual infrastructure, whether it be jersey barriers or cones or barrels or protective equipment such as hard hat and vests, also looking at vehicles so that it makes sure that the maintenance vehicles, the construction vehicles, will stand out that much more to actual AVs. But the interesting thing about these coatings is that to the human eye, they look exactly the same. It's just through these sensors that they pop out. We're also looking at ways that we can make things such as pavement markings stand out so they're more clear, especially in work zones where we have it, where you might have changes in patterns and you might have pavement markings that are no longer relevant in these temporary traffic control setups, that it makes it that much easier for an AV to know where is the clear lane and it's not going to get confused by erroneous pavement markings.
Over the course of this four-year study, what will be involved? How will you study it? What will be your plan of action?
Sure. Knowing that it is not a simple solution, we're basically looking at three predominant elements that we're going to test. So one is communication. So looking at ways to have infrastructure in the vehicle communicate back and forth via various protocols, whether it be a 5G or cellular type of communications. We're also looking at something called dedicated short-range communications, which USDOT has done a lot of work on over the last decade plus. We'll also be looking at machine visioning, and that's where PPG comes into play, helping to make sure that things stand out. And then we'll also be looking at high-definition mapping. Knowing that an HD map is the foundation for a lot of AVs on how they navigate, we're looking at ways that we can actually map out the work zones as we go through and change patterns, or as inspectors are going through and verifying that everything is in place. So tying into existing protocol that we already have to do in work zones, but if we could put sensors on vehicles, maybe we can start to figure out ways to automate that. So looking at that, knowing that there's probably not a one-size-fits-all solution, that's why we're taking those three separate approaches. And as we start to test it, we're going to try and do things incrementally. We figure that's the safest way to doing it. So step one is always figuring out how this is going to work in a simulation. So we'll work with Carnegie Mellon University to put everything through simulation. If it fails in simulation, it's probably going to fail in real life, and we don't want to do it that way. So that's when we would go back and we would adjust things and figure out how to make things work. Then we're going to move into the next phase, which is a closed course testing environment, which we've partnered up with Penn State University for this. So we'll be able to use their Larson's Transportation Institute's test track up in State College region to test things there. And ultimately, by the end of the four-year grant, we would like to do some small-scale live deployments and some controlled work zones that we have figured out everything in the simulation first, figured out everything in a closed environment first, and then verify things in a controlled live environment.
Your department oversees work zones and are also emphasizing safety because of the close proximity of workers. How are you going to ensure the safety of the road workers during the real life, the real active work zone trials?
Sure. So we're going to put every protocol that we can put in place to help out, whether it be intrusion detection, keeping workers far enough back that they can, doing probably low-speed testing, verifying everything in those controlled environments and the simulation first, making sure everyone's comfortable with things. There's always going to be a human driver behind the wheel. There will also be a safety operator in the passenger seat. People will be monitoring, ready to take over control at any moment. So we're trying to put as many safety protocols that we can in place before we actually get to that at the end of those 4 years. So we're trying to build up everything we can in the first 3 years, verifying everything, and only when we are comfortable will we ever go to a live environment.
So closed track and then eventually a live environment if you make it that far, a live work zone. So what is your working hypothesis, Mark? Do you think autonomous vehicles can navigate work zones? You know, switched lanes, narrowed lanes, concrete barriers and cones.
And that's ultimately what we're trying to find out, because if this technology is ever going to make it to a mass deployment on the roadways, they have to. So that is why we're trying to work with industry and work with academia to figure out what needs to be done, knowing that there's benefits that come with vehicle automation, whether it be from the safety side or whether it be even just improving work zone safety, knowing that an automated vehicle is not going to speed through a work zone, or that there can be potential traffic calming measures associated with an AV going through a work zone just because it can control its speed, it can control its pacing, so it's not going to have that accordion stop and go effect that you might have in traditional work zones with human drivers. So as we start to work towards this, we want to figure out what can we do to make this work and figure out if it is possible. And then that can help us determine how we start to address different policies, different protocols, different approaches in the future. And we're hoping this helps us find things that we can do present day that will help out vehicles on the road today, whether it be operated by partially by a computer system within the vehicle or just human drivers altogether, just trying to figure out how can we just make our work zones that much more efficient.
So there is the potential for a larger impact improving the overall worker safety in these zones.
That's our hope to find with this, is that traditionally what we start to see when we start looking at automated vehicles is that even if you talk to a lot of the testers out there, the best thing you could have is clear pavement markings and a smooth road. And if you had something like that, that's just the same for a human driver. But when you start to get into these temporary traffic control scenarios where it's not that simplistic, that's where we're trying to figure out if we can figure out things that work for an AV, odds are it's going to help out a human driver also, and vice versa. So anything that we can start to do that will help out a human driver, ultimately it should help out an AV in the future too.
Mark, let's say you have those incremental successes that you described earlier. When do you think we might see autonomous vehicles regularly driving through work zones on Pennsylvania highways?
It'll probably be after that four-year program is up, clearly, because there's still a lot of work to be done. And even as we proceed down this path, I think there's going to have to be a lot of lessons learned and then working with industry to figure out how can things be integrated and if there's anything from a DOT standpoint that we can do to make things more efficient. So I think you're going to start to see that being 5 years out before you see things consistently occurring in work zones.
Mark Kopko is the director of PennDOT's Office of Transformational Technology. Thanks so much for your time, Mark.
Thank you.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Libraries in America began because of a desire to improve education and to share knowledge. They became public meeting spaces, and many trace their beginnings back to Pittsburgher Andrew Carnegie. How are libraries adapting as the needs of their clients change? WESA's education reporter Sarah Schneider is behind a one-hour special that will air at this time on Monday. She joins us now with a little preview. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning, Kevin.
So what got you interested in the evolution of libraries in our community?
Yeah, so I, as an education reporter, spend a lot of time reporting on traditional education, you know, what's happening formally in the classroom. And I also think a lot about what happens when kids leave the school for the day. And, you know, a lot of kids go to the library right after school. We found that it's for a lot of different reasons. But so that's why I originally wanted to look at this. We also knew that several libraries in our area are at risk of closing for many different reasons, but mostly financial. And so we wanted to look at what happens to communities when those spaces are at risk.
Financial. But what about foot traffic? Are people in using the library in numbers that they used to?
It depends library to library, place to place, right? Especially in our state, because it's such a different, you know, communities look different in, you know, 10-mile ranges. So in Pittsburgh, it seems to be foot traffic is fine and the libraries are keeping up. But then in some rural areas, we found that the libraries maybe are at risk of closing, not because of financial reasons, but because people aren't using them, especially in one of the areas that I profile in the special, Leechburg. And we found that, you know, this library closed in May, and mm-hmm. that was largely because just people weren't going there.
You learned about the efforts to save it, and the 70-year-old woman was behind this.
Right, yeah. So she learned, like most people, that the library was closing from Facebook. They posted taped a sign on the front door that day saying, "We're closing permanently," and she rallied the community. You know, Leechburg's only a town of like 2,000 people, but they were only seeing 8 visitors a week at this library. So they did reopen in September. I was there for that. And so that story is part of this special as well.
Seems like she loves the traditions of the library, but she's aware of the need to change.
Right. And that's what we heard time and time again, this evolution of what the library should look like. You know, people have expectations of what purpose a library should serve. But she had these community meetings saying, you know, if we want to remain relevant, especially for younger people, we have to change.
So how are new offerings like instruments, digital services changing how people do use the libraries?
Sure. So Kathleen Davis is one of the reporters who worked on this special, and she's bringing us a piece about tech and how the Carnegie Library of Pittsburgh specifically has really invested in technology for teenagers and trying to keep them in the library and meet them where they are. So if that doesn't mean they're reading books, that's fine with these librarians. And so that piece really focuses on what draws teenagers to libraries. It's often Wi-Fi. And, you know, there's an overlap with rural communities, too, and lack of broadband access. So they're drawn to libraries there as well.
A lot of us remember the signs, "Be quiet,"
sure.
or even the shing of librarians to keep the noise down. Mm-hmm. Is that still the case, or are they more accepting of activity and liveliness?
It depends on which library you're at. So I went to the Allegheny Library, which is on the north side, and I will say right after school, it is incredibly loud. If you know the video game Fortnite, you heard a lot of that going on. And so people have learned to adapt with that, and the librarians seem to be okay with that. There was no shushing, and they're welcoming kids to be in that space.
And finally, what did you learn that surprised you?
I think what I just mentioned surprised me the most, that librarians are okay with adapting and evolving to meet the needs of patrons. And if that means letting kids play video games and not pushing a book on them, then that seems to be okay.
And are future librarians being trained maybe differently now?
Sure. Yeah. So I spoke to a professor at Pitt. They have a master's degree in library sciences. And she said similar things, that librarians don't know what the technologies will be in 10, 15 years. And so they really have to work to train them now to be adaptable people and to meet those needs.
Right. Yeah. Sarah Schneider is WESA's education reporter. Her special on the evolving role of libraries in our communities will air at 9 a.m. Monday in Place of the Confluence. Thanks so much, Sarah.
Thank you.
And for today, that is the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Tuesday on The Confluence, how do you balance and mesh the needs of residents for access to our waterways with development projects along limited and valuable riverfront property? We'll meet the new president and CEO of Riverlife, Matthew Galuzzo. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance from Christopher Stubbs. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good weekend of good news.